I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And we have the podcast Office Ladies. Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories and lots of laughs.
Follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Overall, is the internet good or bad? By all means, it's definitely good. It allows people across the world to get an education, to get information where they never could have reached that otherwise. We can interact. Social networking is a whole other story.
Yo, welcome to another episode of In a Minute with Evan Lovett, coming to you live from the IAM studios in the heart of Los Angeles. And let me tell you something, this podcast would not exist, LA in a Minute would not exist, and the entire internet would not exist if it were not for my guest today, Leonard Kleinrock, distinguished professor emeritus of computer science at UCLA for more than 60 years, by the way. But this was the man who directed the transmission of the first message between two networked computers, which marked the beginning of the internet. This is significant for Los Angeles, but it's significant for the world. And man, we have a lot to get into. Professor Kleinrock, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate you beyond belief. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Evan. Wonderful to be here.
This is truly an honor. And we have spoken before. We've spent some time in your office. You were very gracious and generous. We talked a little bit about the story of how the internet started, what you've essentially created and where it went. But I feel that this deserves a bigger platform and maybe a more intimate platform to get into some of these stories. So I want to jump in. I know you've told this story dozens, hundreds, thousands of times potentially. But let's get right to the chase. Tell us about the moment with the message and the two computers talking to each other. And then I'm going to kind of work backwards as far as chronologically. But let's talk about that first moment initially.
Sure. Well, the idea of the ARPANET at the time, which became the internet, was to allow someone sitting at one computer to log into a remote computer using the network and use its services there.
1960s, by the way. Right.
1960s. Correct. Now, you do that 20 times a day every time you touch your phone and go to some website.
20. It's about 500, probably, unfortunately. But yes.
In those days, it was novel, and there was no technology to allow that to happen. So basically, the Defense Department, through ARPA, created the ARPANET. And we were chosen to be the first node. For a variety of reasons, we had the technology expertise, the mathematical expertise, et cetera.
And so, this was at UCLA, just to be clear, and to reiterate.
UCLA.
Go Bruins. Go Bruins. Okay.
Great.
Okay.
So in September of 1969, we received the first switch, which you now call a router.
Okay.
In fact, it had a funny name called an interface message processor.
IMP. I've seen that. Yeah.
Which, by the way, Al Gore accidentally called the interfaith message processor.
And by the way, Al Gore, perhaps known for inventing the internet, didn't really invent the internet. But I think we've cleared that up. But yes.
No, he was a great guy, and he's misjudged. He was very important in making this happen. By the way.
Interesting. Okay.
Most knowledgeable person in Washington about the internet.
Wow. Okay. Good to know.
At any rate, so we were the first node.
Yeah.
But one node is not a network. On schedule, a second node, a second router, was placed 350 miles to the north at Stanford Research Institute. Okay. And a high-speed line was connecting these two routers. And that was the first piece of the internet backbone, running at the blazing speed of 50,000 bits per second. You wouldn't pay a nickel for that today.
Right.
In those days, that was high speed. And they connect, SRI, Stanford Research Institute, connected their switch, their router, to their host computer. Now we had two host computers, one at UCLA and one at SRI, and two switches and a link connecting them. So now we had a network. So we wanted to prove how you could actually use this network, which means sit at one computer, log on to this remote computer as if you're a local user there.
Yeah.
It doesn't know you're coming into the network.
Right.
And run something there. So to do that, you have to log in from UCLA to SRI. Now, to log in, All you have to do is type L-O-G, and that machine knows you're typing a command, and the only command that follows L-O-G is login.
Right.
So when you type the G, it'll type the G-I-N for you.
Even back then?
Even back then.
Okay.
These machines were smart.
Yeah.
So here we are, ready to go. I had one of my student programmers down at UCLA, Charlie Klein, logged into our host computer. And he was going to connect to Bill Duval, a programmer up at SRI. Now, we're about to do this thing to move packets through this network.
Right.
But you can't see packets. So we wanted a little more physical understanding. So we connected a telephone link from Charlie, made a telephone call from Charlie to Bill. Now, look at the irony here. We're about to use the telephone network to create a data network, which is going to kill the telephone network.
Right.
The irony was beautiful. So ready to go. So Charlie typed the L and he said, you get the L? And Bill said, yep, got the L. Type the O, you get the O? Yep, got the O. Type the G, you get the G? A crash. So the first message ever on the internet was low, as in lo and behold. I added that later.
Right, you're right. Tell me the moment. So when this is happening, give me the atmosphere in the room. Give me the immediate background. I want to go, we'll go into the deeper background. But at this moment, when this is happening, what did it feel like in that room? Was it excitement? Was it anticipation? Was it nervousness? Give me that.
It was an empty room. Charlie was there alone. I had supervised him. I was walking by that evening. This is 10:30 at night.
Okay.
It was empty, and there was no excitement. In fact, they had to fix this error. It took them a half an hour. And I'll explain what failed.
Yeah.
But they finally got it going correctly. 10:30 at night, October 29th,
wow.
1969.
Yeah.
But the you understand there was a culture and an atmosphere among we nerds. We were solving a good, difficult engineering problem with great promise. But we were focused on making it work. And by the way, nobody had IP, patents, nobody had ownership.
Wow.
We were a team of cooperative workers. We used words like, words that your audience probably don't know. Words like ethics, free, open, shared. You know, this was
our audience knows those words, but the entrepreneur C-level exec types may have to dig a little deeper in their vocabulary to find those again. But yeah,
exactly right.
Right. But you were doing it for the greater good is what you were saying, because there was a mission, really. Not, I don't want to speak in military terms, but you were focused on accomplishing something that would quite literally change the world.
Yes, but that really wasn't in the back of our minds.
Really?
We had to make this connection today.
Yeah.
We had to wire things up, make sure the technology worked. And, you know, that evening went home, went to sleep. Nothing happened. But in the background, of course, we were thinking, we had a vision. We understood where this might go, but it didn't enter the room that night. That night was just a step in this long journey.
Right. What was the, so leading up to that, now, I know that this was in the backdrop of, Cold War, Vietnam War. I mean, the world was really in flux, to say the least. Chaos would potentially be a better word. An arms race against USSR. With the United States. And I think ultimately, as you said, you know, funding came from the Defense Department. So this really was, at least in some capacity, a defense initiative, right? Is that fair to say? Or how do you frame that?
The way you phrase it, you put a condition, you said, in some capacity.
Yeah.
So let's explore that.
Yeah.
The source, do you want to get back to Sputnik at this point? Or?
Yeah, get now. The floor is yours, yeah.
1957, 1958, yeah. That academic year was denoted the International Geophysical Year. Scientists across the planet were studying the planet, the mountains, the rivers, the oceans, the atmosphere, and collectively and cooperatively across the world. This started basically in September of 1957.
Okay.
But son of a gun, the Russians jumped the gun. And on October 4th, 1957, they launched Sputnik. Sputnik was the first Earth artificial Earth orbiting satellite. And it went around the Earth and it went beep, 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 and annoyed everybody.
Right. Okay.
Including then President Eisenhower. And he said, my gosh, we are no longer leader in science. The Russians have proven it. And that will never happen again.
Wow.
So 4 months later, in February 1958, he formed what is called the Advanced Research Projects Agency.
There goes ARPA.
Right? ARPA.
Yeah.
An agency under the Department of Defense. Why under the Department of Defense? Because they had money. And they could denote, they can do what Eisenhower wanted, which was to bring the country back up to primacy in science.
Right.
How do you do that? You fund education and research
across the
country.
Absolutely.
And so they started funding. They created, within ARPA, they had some little offices, an office for chemistry, physics, space, etc.
And just pouring resources into these departments because we didn't want to be surpassed. We were surpassed.
Exactly.
And now we need to reestablish American, I want to use the word superiority, but you know, we're at the cutting edge. We want to be at the forefront. So
exactly what. And in 1962, they formed an additional office to support computer research. Yeah. And it was called the Information Processing Techniques Office, IPTO.
Okay.
Now, what did these guys do? The man who started that was a fellow named Licklider, a professor at MIT.
Okay.
And this man was brilliant. He wasn't even a computer scientist. But he recognized we have to pour the money in and we have to give it in a way which will foster creativity and growth. So he would go to the best researchers he knew around the country. For example, he would go to MIT and go to Marvin Minsky, one of the fathers of artificial intelligence. And he would say to Marvin, Marvin, here's a pile of money. You're a great researcher. You've done some very significant things. Shoot for the moon.
Yeah.
You can have this money for a long time. Failure's okay. Keep going. And we're not going to watch or control you. We're not going to judge you.
Right, right.
Go for it. Now, what does Marvin do with the money? His salary is paid by MIT. He uses that money to fund his graduate students. He'll go to a graduate and say, graduate student, make a seven-legged robot. I'm not going to tell you how to do it. Figure it out. Talk to your classmates, maybe across the country, other classmates. Go figure it out. So here's money. Failure's okay. Keep going. Now, imagine what kind of a research and environment and culture that was.
Beautiful.
It couldn't have been better. Yeah. He went around the country doing that. So things began to blossom. Now, in answer to your question, though, what does Marvin know about the military? What does ARPA tell Marvin? He doesn't say there's a military application in mind.
Yeah.
He says, Marvin, do research. So down at our level, the professors, the principal investigators, we were not at all suggested or driven to have military applications. This was a research project.
Yeah.
And neither did our graduate students. But who did we speak to at ARPA was a program manager.
Right.
And they never brought any military mindset to us. But within ARPA, there was a director. And that director would speak to Department of Defense.
Yeah.
And Department of Defense would speak to the president. So in some capacity, as you go up the line, there must have been, and I'm sure there was, expectation that there would be military application of all this technology. But it wasn't present at the level where we were doing the work.
You guys were able to do that independently, autonomously, without feeling that sort of pressure, which I guess wasn't even pressure in that.
Exactly.
So that's a beautiful environment. Tell me about, set the scene. So you grew up in the Bronx, New York, correct?
Manhattan.
Oh, Manhattan. Okay. So you grew up in Manhattan.
Yeah.
Give us a little bit first on your background. Were you a tinkerer? Were you into, were you putting stuff together, taking stuff apart? Where did this come from? The foundation of who you ended up becoming?
Well, like any other kid, I was interested in gadgets, puzzles, sports, and comic books.
Okay.
And as a kid, I would take things apart and most often could put them back together. Not always.
Right, right.
But one day, I was reading a Superman comic book. I was in elementary school. And in the centerfold, it described how to build something called a crystal radio, whatever that was.
Yeah.
But it said you could build it out of parts you can find around your home. And when you're done, you can tune in different radio stations. And it wouldn't cost you a nickel.
Okay.
I said, I want to try this.
Yeah.
So what parts did you need? Well, first thing I needed was an empty toilet paper roll.
Got that.
Yeah, right. I needed some wire to make a coil. I found that in the street.
Okay.
I needed something called a crystal radio. Well, you can make your own crystal. If you get your father's old razor blade and a piece of pencil lead, it becomes a crystal, a diode, basically, which is what you need.
Wow.
Well, that was easy. And then I needed an earpiece to listen. No, I didn't have one. But I knew in the candy store down the street there was a telephone booth. And in the telephone booth was a telephone. And on the handset was an earpiece.
Yeah.
And it turns out in those days you could unscrew the damn thing. So I stole this earpiece.
Wow, okay.
You know, a little elementary school kid. So I'm set, except I needed one more part. It was called a variable capacitor. One of these things that will help you tune. I didn't have that around the house. I didn't know where to get it.
I don't think that's a common household item. Doesn't sound like, but right.
But I knew where I could get one. In those days, this was, I was just a kid. There were war surplus stores on Canal Street in downtown Manhattan where you could buy electronics. So my mother took me down on the subway. I walked up to the first store and I banged my fist on a table. I said, I need a variable capacitor. And the wonderful clerk behind the counter said, what size? I had no idea.
Okay.
And I told him why I wanted it. He knew just what I wanted.
Yes.
He sold it to us for a nickel, brought it home, wired it up, and son of a gun, there was music in my ear.
Wow.
And this was magic.
Yeah, it's a eureka moment. Absolutely.
And by the way, it's still magic. I'm still trying to figure out how it worked. I know the electronics and electromagnetism, but action at a distance is magic.
Wow.
And it was that magic that really caught my instincts. And so I started building radios. I would borrow broken down radios, take them apart, and put them back together as a new radio. And I did that as a kid. So I was very much interested in electronics.
Yeah.
But, when I look back, I built a lot of model airplanes, flying models. I didn't join clubs. You think there'd be a bunch of kids building radios or model air. I did all on my own. In my apartment with my parents, and bless my mother, she let me make the biggest mess behind the sofa. She didn't know what I was doing, but she didn't stop me.
Yeah.
If there was discipline and, no, you can't make a mess, it would have slowed me down.
Wow.
So I credit her with basically giving me the freedom to do what I wanted to do. And so I built radios. I was fortunate enough to go to the Bronx High School of Science and Mathematics, and learn more about radio electronics. And then I was all set. Well, I wanted to go to college, of course.
Yeah.
But I couldn't afford it. We were quite poor. So I rode away to every chamber of commerce in America looking for scholarships. And I got a bunch, but it wasn't enough. I couldn't handle travel and living. So the only place I could probably go to was the wonderful, magnificent City College of New York.
Right.
CCNY.
Yeah.
Tuition was $12 a semester. It was a fee. And, CCNY has graduated more Nobel laureates than any other private university in America.
Wow, to
still,
this day, huh?
It's ending.
Right.
Great school. So I was all set to go that summer between high school and college. I was a lifeguard in Lower East Side of Manhattan. I broke up more fights than I saved lives, and I saved 14 people.
Wow, good stat though, saved 14 people. That's
but crazy. I'll tell you a story. It was a tough neighborhood.
Yeah.
And some people would jump into the deep water and they didn't know how to swim, so you get them. And there's a kid that jumped into the deep water and he came up and said, hey, save me. So I dove off the tower, got him, brought him up to the surface, and he said, ha, 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 I was just fooling. And I was enraged because I'm going after this guy when someone else might need me.
Yeah.
So I put my arms around his shoulder, my feet around his waist, and down we went. Brought him up, took him down again. We came up, get out, a fight's about to start. And I was surrounded by his buddies.
Yeah, of course, outnumbered, yeah.
And at that point, the chief lifeguard stopped it. It would have been, I may not have been here today. Right.
Wow.
At any rate, so I was a lifeguard that summer.
Yeah.
And all set to go to CCNY in the fall. This is 1951.
Okay.
Fall of 51. But I couldn't really afford the $12 because my parents needed me to bring in money to help support the
and
house.
And that was 12 per semester, you were saying, right?
12 per semester.
Wow. Okay.
Because, you know, I was working all through high school, you know, as a movie usher and a bunch of other things. They needed, so I couldn't go to day session. I had to get a job in the day at a small industrial electronics firm in lower Manhattan. And I went to night school. Now, and I was going to study electrical engineering.
Yeah.
Who goes to night school for an electrical engineering degree? Crazies, dropouts, very dedicated poor kids, and the GIs coming back from World War II.
Okay.
And these guys, these GIs, understood what life was about. They weren't there to play around. They were serious. Well, the rest of these people are crazies, if you will.
Right.
So I had a wonderful experience with a mixed group of classmates and a mixed group of faculty. Who was teaching at night?
Yeah.
Engineers working in the daytime. So I got a lot of practical experience as well as theoretical understanding.
Real life lessons and exchange of those kinds of ideas in addition and to scholastic. Yeah.
It was really important. In the daytime, I was working as an assistant engineer. And I learned all about implementation and practical things. And there were great electrical engineers in a small company who taught me a lot of stuff. So I had this wonderful mix, which is important, of the practical side of engineering and the theoretical side. I'll give you an example. One day, the professor came in at night and he said, "See this? It's called a transistor. They had just come out. And, you know, transistors like vacuum tubes are supposed to amplify things." He says, "This is a better thermometer than it is an amplifier because it's very sensitive to heat and it'll change its characteristics according to the temperature. And here's how to fix it. Here's how to compensate for it. There's a way to do it." Now, had I been a daytime student, teacher would have said, "Here's a transistor. Here's the way it works. End of story."
Yeah.
The richness was not there. So I was very fortunate to get not only the how things work, but why they work that way.
And that laid the groundwork, of course, for just how you think and then how
Absolutely.
You would accomplish. So give us the pathway. So how did you end up at UCLA? And at this point, what was your ambition? What were your goals? What were you thinking you were going to be doing as a career?
Well, I wanted to be an electrical engineer.
Okay.
I hadn't been thinking about graduate school.
Right.
But it took me 5.5 years at night to get my bachelor's degree,
yeah.
which ordinarily takes 4.5 in the daytime. So I was really pushing when every summer session, you know, I'd work all day, go to school at night, spend maybe an hour or two in a social club called Houseplant at UCLA, at MIT, at CCNY.
Okay.
Get home after midnight, get up at 6:30, down to work. So when the heck did I study?
Yeah.
And the answer was on the subway.
There you
go. I wrote all the equations on a piece of paper. And, you know, not like this, like, because it was crowded in the subway.
Hi, I'm PJ Vogt, and I want to tell you about my podcast, Search Engine. We try to make sense of the world, one question at a time. No question too big, no question too small. We will even answer your questions if you send them in. Stuff like, what happens when a cemetery goes out of business? What should we do about teens using AI to do their homework? Who buys luggage at the airport luggage store? Follow and listen to Search Engine in partnership with Odyssey, wherever you get your podcasts.
But it was very effective. And I graduated first in my class day and night.
Wow.
But one day I was told that there was a professor coming from MIT Lincoln Laboratory to describe a wonderful scholarship to get a master's degree. So I went there. It was in the afternoon, took time off. And he describes this fantastic program that MIT Lincoln Laboratory would support you as a graduate student. They pay tuition, they pay living, they pay you a salary. You could work at MIT Lincoln Lab in the summers doing research. What could be better?
Yeah.
And the gentleman who was talking said, after I speak, after the lecture's over, go to the professor in the back of the room and ask for an application. So I did. I went to the back, and I asked for an application. And it was an electrical engineering professor there, whom I didn't know. And I said, I'd like an application. He asked me my name. He said, I don't recognize you. I said, well, you wouldn't. I go to night school. He says, night school? Get the hell out of here.
Come on. Okay.
Honestly,
okay.
He wouldn't give me an application. So I rode away. I got the application. I won the scholarship. But, you know.
Wow, that guy almost ended it before it started. Okay.
Well, interesting. He has a name I won't tell you on the air.
Right. Okay, fair.
But some years later, I got an honorary degree, doctorate from CCNY. And I gave the commencement lecture to this sea of young students. And I told that story. And he was still on the faculty, but I didn't give his name.
did he? Was he sheepish? Did he?
He didn't even recognize it. He didn't even recognize
really?
It.
Really? Okay. Fair enough. Okay. So give us this cross-country jaunt. How'd you end up at UCLA?
So I went to MIT, got a master's degree. And by the way, I got married while I was at an undergraduate City College.
Where'd you have the time? Was she riding on the subway with you or helping you study?
I met her at CCNY to dance.
Okay.
And so I had to get out of the house. It was just too confining, too difficult. You know, the hours were bad. So I got married a couple of years before I graduated. I don't suggest that.
Oh, man. Okay. I could imagine.
And so when I got to MIT, we scheduled to have our first child when I finished my master's degree. So I'm finishing it. But my supervisor, my PhD, my master's thesis supervisor said, Len, you got to get a PhD. I said, I don't want a PhD. I got a great job at Lincoln Laboratory. I got a child coming. I need to earn some serious money.
Yeah.
You got to get a PhD. So he kept pushing me. So I said, look, if I'm going to do this, I have two conditions. Condition one, I want to work for the best professor at MIT. And condition number two, I don't want to work on a piddly little problem. I want to work on one with impact.
Yeah.
And so I decided to go ahead for that. And I reached out to the best professor I knew, Claude Shannon, magnificent man. He created information theory, coding theory. In many ways, he's responsible for the digital revolution we live in today.
I wonder if that's what Claude is named after, the AI.
Yes, it is.
Oh,
I believe
wow.
it is. I believe
okay.
it is, yes.
Claude Shannon, okay.
He was not one who easily gave praise, you know. And he worked at Bell Labs originally, before he came to MIT. He was a juggler. He rode a unicycle down the halls of this venerable Bell Labs, Bell Telephone Laboratory, great research.
Yeah.
He would juggle, ride the unicycle, going downstairs. I mean, and he'd take things apart. But his mathematical brain was untouchable.
Yeah.
So he had the ability that I mentioned before to understand the practical, intuitive side of the systems he was making mathematical breakthroughs on. And you go into this man's office. He'd be this great mathematical mind. In one hand, he'd have a little differential gear. In the other hand, a Swiss Army knife. And he'd be unscrewing the damn thing. I mean... So that mixing of the practical and the theoretical and the intuition and the understanding was what made him so great. And I wanted to basically, I had a similar background I wanted to learn from. So sure enough, he took me on.
And then, so how did that get you cross coast to
well,
Los Angeles?
The research I did, again, I wanted something important.
Yeah.
I didn't want to follow Shannon's students who were all working on what he had left over, which were hard problems with small consequence. And I was surrounded by computers at MIT, and I knew one day, sooner or later, they'll have to talk to each other. So I said, look, here's a problem that nobody's looking at. It's a really hard problem. It's going to have impact. And I had an approach, how to create the mathematics of a network, which would support computers talking to each other. That was perfect for me. So I did that. I did my thesis on that. Published it as a book, actually, shortly thereafter. So when I graduated, I had this great job at MIT Lincoln Laboratory, a research position. But Lincoln Lab, bless them, they said, look, we've supported your master's and your PhD. We don't want you to feel obligated to work for us. I said, but I really want to. They said, look, take a look outside, see what's out there.
Wow.
So I did a tour around the country. I got a great offer from Bell Labs, other research companies,
yeah,
some of the larger technology companies. And for some reason, UCLA thought I wanted to get a faculty position. So they interviewed me, and they made me an offer.
Was UCLA on your radar before that?
Not at all. You understand, well, this job they offered me was at half the salary I was going to get at Lincoln Lab.
Okay.
Was all the way across the country in the Wild West.
Had you been to LA at this point?
To interview, yes.
Okay.
That was
okay.
It. That was, I saw this place. It was colorful, low buildings.
Yeah.
Warm.
The horizon. That's right.
But I had no relatives here. I knew nobody here. I'd done a tiny bit of teaching at MIT. Totally new. So I went to Lincoln Lab. I said, look, I really want to work here. But there's this interesting job at UCLA they're offering me to be an assistant professor. What advice do you give me? And bless them, they said, Len, try it. If you don't like it, come back.
Wow.
What a generous
offer.
Gracious,
yeah.
So in 1963, I was at UCLA as an assistant professor, and I'm still here.
Okay, 60 plus years. That's incredible. I want to take a little pause just to discuss, not a literal pause, but a sidebar, I should say. You already said colorful, low buildings, warm. Just give me some other first impressions of Los Angeles. And in fact, while we're at it, what has remained your impression or become your impressions over the past 60 plus years?
Well, the university itself was very attractive.
Yeah.
Beautiful buildings, no skyscrapers. Now they have them.
Right.
In those
right.
days,
right.
The office I got, I could look out across to Westwood. Westwood was then a somewhat thriving college town, but not quite. It never really made it.
I know. Westwood, come on. I wish. It's just not a college town. It's just not.
But I also noticed that they build their homes here strangely. They weren't using bricks. They were using plywood as the walls because they didn't need the strength of bricks.
Yeah.
It was a totally different environment. And it was attractive, and there was the Hollywood sign. The Dodgers, I'm not sure they had moved here yet, but I was a Brooklyn Dodgers fan in New York.
Oh, right. Okay.
In New York. When they came out here, it was different. Different,
really? Even though you came out as well, almost around the same time.
Right.
That's interesting. Are you a Dodger fan today?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
I actually had referred to you as the Vin Scully of computer scientists, by the way, for better or for worse. So
I think
articulate, energetic, vivacious, thoughtful, insightful, intelligent. So with Los Angeles, just to go on and kind of close this out, real quick, what do you think about the evolution of Los Angeles since you've been here? What is your take today on this?
Well, it's changed a lot.
Yeah.
First of all, the buildings have grown. Westwood used to have low buildings.
Yeah.
Now you can't see across Westwood.
Right.
It never developed as a college town. It used to rain here only in January. Now that's totally unpredictable.
Right, right.
The traffic's gotten worse, although the smog has improved, by the way.
Yes, absolutely. You see those shots from the, going back to the 50s through 90s. Yeah. But yeah, it's been crystal clear recently, for the most part. But yeah.
We took our first apartment in Westchester near the airport.
Hey, okay.
It was inexpensive enough. And I rode a motor scooter to UCLA.
Okay.
A Lambretta. It was a great motor scooter, 50 miles an hour max. My wife finally forced me to get rid of it when I had an accident.
Oh, yeah.
But riding up Sepulveda Boulevard, I didn't realize there were mountains in the hills. You couldn't see them. It was amazing. So it was very different then. I bought a wonderful car in 1966.
Okay.
It was a 63 Impala Super Sport convertible.
Shoot.
With the six lights in the back.
Yeah.
Beautiful convertible. Big. No power steer. Big wheel. I kept that. It only had 1,200 miles on it.
Yeah.
I bought it for $1,200. Still had plastic on the floor. And I drove that till 1989.
Wow.
When it was stolen.
Oh, dang it.
Anyway, it was. So I was riding around a convertible here in L.A.
Yeah.
I gave my students lots of rides. They enjoyed it. And my kids.
Of course.
It was a great time, but it's changed a lot. The The students themselves have changed a lot.
Yeah.
And that's a true across the country, by the way. The way they approach things, the thinking, the curiosity is way down. The innovation is way down, believe it or not.
What do you attribute that to?
Computers.
Wow. Okay. Let's talk the hard questions. When you developed, so you see the success of the computers talking to each other, the network.
Yeah.
And that was through packet switching, which was your theory, right? And I don't want to bog down the conversation too much, but that's something that you created.
I'll modify that if you want.
Yeah. Give me the short version so we can get on to the next.
Why didn't we use the telephone network to connect computers together?
Yeah.
The reason is they use a technology called circuit switching. When you and I speak on a telephone through a network, a voice network, there's a whole series of links that connect us. And while we're talking, those links are dedicated to our conversation.
Right.
Even if I stop to have a cup of coffee or silent. Now, in speech, you're silent about one third of the time. And that's perfectly acceptable. But when computers talk to each other, they're silent well over 95% of the time. Imagine you're sitting at your keyboard and you hit a key and it gets wrapped up into a packet and goes, It's gone over the network, over a gigabit per second line, for example. By the time you hit the next key, it's been an eternity. And if there was a dedicated sequence of high-speed lines connecting me with the device I'm talking to, it'd be extremely wasteful. These are high-speed, expensive lines doing nothing. So it was clear to me you couldn't have a circuit switch network which dedicated lines. We needed to have a way which dynamically assigned the lines. When I send something through the link, when I'm done, someone else can use it immediately.
Yeah.
It's called dynamic resource sharing, sharing the high-speed lines. Packet switching is one way to do it. There are a number of other ways where polling, I'll ask you, do you need a line? Yes, you got it. You don't need it? You don't get it. Somebody else does.
Yeah.
So this sharing, immediate sharing of high-speed lines was the important part of my research. And it turns out that packet switching was the implementation of the ARPANET and the internet. So when you say packet switching, it's an example. And yes, I did create a mathematical theory of data networks. The current manifestation is packet switching.
Wow. Okay. So these computers talk. We're going back to the UCLA, SRI, LO, lo and behold, the computers talk. At what point did you guys start realizing the possibilities as well as the ramifications? Take me through that.
I'm going to answer that in a very strange way.
Okay.
I'll ask you, when do you think anybody had a vision of what the internet is today? How far back? And I won't force you to answer.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you what this person said, and maybe it'll give you a clue.
Okay.
And I'm going to paraphrase what this person said. It will be possible for a businessman in New York to reach out across the ocean to his colleagues, say, in London or anywhere, using a device no larger than a watch to immediately and almost no cost send any drawing, picture, voice, text. That I've paraphrased it. Now, first of all, you have to agree with me. Whoever that person is, they're talking about what we now call the internet.
Yeah, 100%. Absolutely. It sounds like what we're doing every single day.
So when do you think that was quoted? I'll tell you. It was Nikola Tesla. In 1908, more than 100 years ago.
Wow.
So we had this, he had this vision, but that vision had to wait for the technology to catch up. Now, along the way, there have been other visionaries, H.G. Wells, Vannevar Bush, Licklider, myself, even before the internet began, where we saw where this was going. In fact, to give you an example, I articulated a vision, and by the way, I'm not giving you baloney here because it was printed July 2nd, 1969, before the internet began. And in that, I explained that basically, and I'm going to paraphrase again, this network would be a system that's always on, always available. Anybody can get on from any location with any device and it will be invisible like electricity.
Wow.
Now, think about that vision.
Yeah.
Much of it's happened. Some of it hasn't. It's not invisible yet. This is too complicated to get on the network with. But I totally missed social networks.
Oof.
Big time miss.
Yeah. Well, you can't foresee everything. I mean, come on. Yeah.
But the point is the vision was there.
Yeah.
And it was waiting for the technology to catch up. And it did in the late 60s, early 70s. And so we knew where this could go. But this network we created in 69, 70, it was a research network. It was an engineering challenge. It was not meant to sell cookies to you over the over the internet. And it was challenging. We were making great things happen. And we could see the engineering challenge. Remember, that was the culture we had.
Right.
And so it sailed along beautifully up until 1988, when Robert Morris, a graduate student, unleashed the first virus. And it reached about 10% of the people on the internet at the time. And we saw that. We said, ouch. And we said, oh, well, this guy's just a hacker. He claimed he didn't even release it, that it's, his office mate did. But it, we took it down.
Okay.
And we ignored it. His father, who happened to be working for the CIA at the time, was quoted as saying, it's a good thing my son did this. And we said, what kind of a rebel are you? He was right. He was warning us where this network could go.
Wow.
But we ignored it. And during the period up till 1988, the network grew. It was easy, it was rich, very interesting. From 1988 to 1994, it continued to grow. And three important things happened. First, the NSF, National Science Foundation, wanted to connect their supercomputers around the country together, and they were using the, they decided to use the ARPANET.
Okay.
And they beefed it up. It was now called the NSFNet. And we began to see as a result, not only computer scientists, but we saw chemists, physicists, biologists, physiologists, oceanographers joining the network. So the constituency grew dramatically.
Right.
But these are all scientists. Now, where does a research chemist work? Either at a university or in the research department of a large chemical company.
Okay.
So here they are in this research department. And what are these guys doing? Email. The most seductive application for those early days. Now, email is very seductive,
yeah,
very visible. And outside this research group, you got, you know, the marketing people, the staff, the drive, and the executives say, wow, we want this email.
Yeah.
And that's when the dot-coms began to appear, saying, we want access to this. Second thing, Al Gore.
There we go. Okay.
In 1988, I testified for one of his Senate subcommittees on a report I had chaired called Towards a National Research Network. And he picked that up. He realized we need a big, strong backbone network to support research and science. So he convinced the first President Bush to pass into law the High Performance Computing Communication Act of 1991, the Information Superhighway.
Okay.
So now we had a gigabit backbone which could support the dot-coms that wanted it. What was missing? What was missing was a convenient, easy user interface. Along comes the web, solving that. So suddenly we got this combination, and it's just pregnant, ready to go. On April 12th, 1994, the first broad-based spam message got released by a couple of lawyers.
Okay.
And I have a copy of that email, by
yes,
the way.
Yes, I would love to see that. But yeah, go on.
And what did it say? It said, to the world, there's a green card lottery coming up. Hire us, pay us, and we'll help you get into the lottery. What do you mean? You can't advertise on our engineering research network, we said. So we sent email back to them. You can't do this. How dare you? Shame on you. We sent so much email back to their server that we took it down.
Wow.
Okay.
So as an unintended consequence of the first spam email, we created the first denial of service attack. But it was too late.
Yeah.
Now the commercial world saw what was going on.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, this is not a research network. This is a shopping machine. We can make money out of this. It's a gossip chamber. It's an entertainment channel. So suddenly the entire effort by the people who were driving the internet, the commercial world, the high-tech companies, we can make money with this. And we're still living in that world today. We're being exploited.
Yeah.
Our privacy is being invaded. And the research side shifted. So basically, in the early 90s, it made a major shift. And here we are today, still suffering the dark side of the internet, which emerged. Now, you know, what should we have been able to prevent that?
Could you? That's like preventing, you know, human nature almost at that point.
So you're right. But we could have done some things to help. Back in the early days, remember ethics, free, shared, open? We had no reason to protect ourselves from each other. We were well behaved. We behaved. We had good netiquette.
Okay. Right.
What we could have done was install two safeguards. One, basically, strong user identification. You have to be able to prove that it's you talking to me over the network. What mechanism can we do with that? We don't have that today, by the way. Second, we should have a good file authentication. What you send me is what I receive, and nobody in the middle changed it.
Yeah.
And had we created those two, we should have turned them off immediately because we didn't need it. But crank it up as these abuses began to arise. And they would have slowed down some of the abuses, right, but it wouldn't have solved the problem of fake news, of bad players. I mean, what we created, what's the power of the internet? To allow some poor, sloppy person living in a basement with banana peels all over the place, if they have a laptop and a connection to the internet, they can reach out to millions of people at no cost, immediately, anonymously. And that's a wonderful power and a wonderful curse in a way. And now, in addition to them launching a fake news, AI is there and social networks is there to multiply that by the millions.
Yeah.
So this is the world you're living in now, Evan.
And do you think that, going back to your point about the students not being as curious about perhaps not being as intellectually rich, that sort of apply, how does that apply? Like, apply that to the fact that, you know, you've seen the students change and we've all seen the world change, maybe in some ways not for the better. What is that about the internet and that access and about that ability to be that guy in the basement and with the banana peels? Like, how did that sort of suppress the innate curiosity and willingness and want to learn about new things?
Well, as I said, I blame it on computers to begin with.
Yeah.
Computers, I say, are the worst enemy of critical thinking, because our students these days relegate too much to reach into a computer to get an answer or get information. And if you're an engineer and you don't know Archimedes' principle, you can't use it in your daily thinking. You know, most of the good research takes place while you're driving, while you're showering, while you're about to fall asleep. Because if it's not up here, you can't put things together.
Yeah.
So the curiosity and the drive and the innovation has been relegated to the computer. Now, certainly the machine has enormous value. Yes, if I want to find out some weird fact, I can reach out there and get it. Or some, you know, maybe even ChatGPT will tell me how to change my login on my computer. The detail I don't have to necessarily know. But the students now have relegated too much to the computer. And, you know, I harken back to Shannon. You know, he could imagine multidimensional space. He could live in his mind there and see how things worked. And from that, he produced his great works. Well, students don't have that curiosity anymore. They don't. If a student comes to me with a result to some problem I gave them, they'll give me a graph, Y versus X.
Yeah.
I'll say, oh, that's interesting. This piece of it looks like a straight line. What's the physical meaning of the slope in terms of the problem you're solving? No idea. Whereas in the old days, you know, if they didn't have a machine to simulate, they had to think about the model they were making and how it affected it. And I'll say, well, look, why is the asymptote there or the breakpoint here? I say, what if I double the number of anything in there?
Yeah.
What? How will it behave? And the answer is, oh, I'll simulate it again. I say, you just failed. You can't understand. You don't have a mathematical model. And even if they get an answer, now here's the result. They don't ask, why does the result look that way? What's behind it? Can I apply that thinking, that understanding, that intuition to another problem? All of those students aren't doing that as much these days. They used to be great at it.
Yeah.
And if you can't exploit what you have and can't think deeply, I like to say there's two parts. I mentioned it before to great understanding. One is, what does an engineer do? An engineer takes a new device, takes it apart, breaks it, builds it, experiments with it, measures it to figure out how it works. What does a scientist or mathematician do? It doesn't care so much how it works. It wants to know, why does it work that way? What's the physics and the mathematics behind it?
Yeah.
So you can be one or the other, or you can be both. And if you're both, you're invaluable. And we're not getting that why. We're getting the how.
Oof, because we have the answers at our fingertips as part of it.
That's exactly right. That's a great way to put it.
So, net, let me put you on the spot for a second. Net benefit or net negative to society?
Net benefit. No question
okay.
about it.
Okay.
No question about it. And we have to learn to deal with the dark side. And it's difficult. And we're facing some very serious challenges.
So I want to get in, and I want to honor your time. There's a thousand more questions I could ask, infinite really, but.
Hey there, I'm Kendra Adachi, and my show, The Lazy Genius Podcast, helps you be a genius about the things that matter and lazy about the things that don't, and you get to decide what matters. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to give you a new way to see. Episodes of the Lazy Genius Podcast are full of compassionate time management tips and permission slips to do what makes sense for you. New episodes drop every Monday. Follow and listen to the Lazy Genius Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
We got to get into AI. You talk about new challenges, new chapters. You know, that's the next horizon. The next, it's already here. Going back to Claude Shannon, explain what, tell me about AI in the sense of what can we expect from it?
Okay. Again, I'm going to take you back.
Okay, yeah.
The person who coined the term artificial intelligence was the other father of artificial intelligence, John McCarthy.
Okay.
He coined the term in 1956. And he collected a bunch of scientists in 1957 about artificial intelligence. Claude Shannon was there, by the way.
Yeah.
And Marvin Minsky was there and some other great people. And so the early artificial intelligence work was basically called symbolic AI, where you give a program a set of rules and it follows those rules and maybe can interpret language, maybe it can move a robot arm, maybe you can play a game of checkers, et cetera.
Yeah.
And by the way, talking about checkers, there's a very interesting occurrence that has great implication today. A researcher named Arthur Samuels, early 70s, late 60s, wrote a checker playing program. He could play checkers with the computer on an IBM 701. He somehow got seduced into writing that program because he thought that Claude Shannon had already written a chess playing program. But Shannon had not. He'd simply written a paper about writing a program.
Okay.
So that was great because it pushed Samuel to write the checker playing program. And this was a great checker playing program. He could play, it learned by rote, a very simple way. It used basically all kinds of clever algorithms. And it was anticipating what was going on now with learning algorithms.
Wow. Okay.
And the story I want to tell you is one day when he was playing with it, he changed the algebraic sign of the objective function from plus to minus by accident, hit the wrong key.
Yeah.
The machine was now programmed to lose. He started playing with it, and he couldn't tell it was trying to lose. Because to lose good, you have to capture control of the board and then the big sacker.
Got to be a good fake, yeah. Right.
And suddenly, bang, and he thought, now, there's a lesson here. We are given, we will be given, are giving, artificially intelligent programs responsibility. Suppose we asked an AI program to increase the economy of the United States.
Okay.
And it's off doing it. And suppose it's either corrupted or accidentally decide to drop the economy.
Yeah.
And if you can't tell what it's doing, this could be serious consequences. And we don't know how these neural networks really perform. It's a, because the history back, you know, symbolic AI in the early days, there were even early on inklings of what we now call neural networks, which is the basic AI system you're working with today. And there were AI winters and came and went. And finally, the neural networks began to appear and do great things. They do pattern recognition. They do language computation, et cetera. We don't know how they work. But they're great. Now, there's a lot of work going on to make them explainable. We're trying to do that now.
Right.
But we love them. They do what we want.
Yeah.
But, you know, related to this ability to not understand what they're doing, we don't understand the domain for which they're good. I'll give you an example. Highly optimized systems of any type work very well in the domain for which they were designed. If you move outside that domain, they collapse colossally. Example, AM radio versus FM radio.
Okay. Yeah.
Here's a base station. AM radio is always terrible and it gets worse and worse and worse when you get far away from the tower.
Right.
FM is terrific. It's beautiful until you reach its limit and then it collapses dramatically.
Okay. Yeah.
So in general, optimized systems work well if you keep them in the domain for which they were designed.
Okay, good, good.
Now let's take a highly optimized neural network. And it works beautifully in the range for which it was designed. But we don't know what the domain is. We don't know where it's going to collapse.
Holy, right.
So along with that understanding and knowing at some point they can collapse is very dangerous. So to answer your question, what are we going to do with these things?
Yeah.
Well, to jump to the final question you're going to ask, how are we going to solve this? I have a hope. And the hope is that AI itself will be the tool that corrects some of these big failures. And I say that because these artificial intelligence, these new, they know everything that's going on in the network. Much more than you or any scientist can. And they watch everything going on and they have tools to make adjustments. Now, will they go rogue? Will they go malicious? That's a difficult question, but I think it's only through AI that we're going to have the power to control these babies. It's a hope. It's not a, I don't have a design. I don't have the research, but I think therein lies the approach.
But isn't that kind of making an assumption? This is almost philosophical, but isn't that almost making the assumption that the AI is programmed or that it is a good, that it has good intentions or?
Well, there were good cops and bad cops.
Right.
And they get corrupted. And I don't have the answer to that. The other question is, we're going to give up our humanity.
Yeah.
And relegate everything
cede,
to these artificial.
Cede the power, cede the decisions to AI. What happens then?
Don't ask me.
That's why you're here.
No,
wow.
It's a tough question. And I don't know how we protect against that. You know, we can put rules down.
Yeah.
Put boundaries on it. But there always will be the hackers and the bad actors who will go beyond that. And how we control them is not clear. The penalties are not strong enough necessarily. So I can't answer that.
Do you think we're already too far down the road?
No. No, we have the ability to be creative, be smart enough to find ways to do this. And you asked before, overall, is the internet good or bad? By all means, it's definitely good. It allows people across the world to get an education, to get information where they never could have reached that otherwise. We can interact. Social networking is a whole other story.
okay, all right. To bring it back down a little bit, Any advice to anybody who's thinking about getting into computer science or into your field or into AI? What do you think to any young, curious types, scholastic types? Because they are out there. And I know there are some brilliant minds, walking around of all ages right now.
So I'll tell you the advice I give my students.
Yeah.
I have a bunch of lessons. First of all, believe in yourself that you can do good things.
Best advice for anything. Yeah, correct.
In my life experience, I've had an opportunity to bump into these problems. And I'll give you one story about my background, which you can eliminate if you like.
No, I like it. Go.
I grew up in Manhattan. Manhattan is a concrete jungle. There's very few trees around.
Yeah.
And I love Tarzan.
Tarzana, by the way, right down
and
the road.
I wanted to be in the jungle. I wanted to be an Indian riding a horse with arrows and all. So the only way to get out to nature was to join the Boy Scouts.
Okay.
Because we go on camping trips. So I joined the Boy Scouts. And I worked my way up to a Star Scout, which is like 5 merit badges. And you get great leadership training. You become a patrol leader, a senior patrol leader. And as soon as I got my Star badge, a scoutmaster said, "Len, you can become the first Eagle Scout in this troop." We never had one. Now, in those days, to become an Eagle Scout was really tough. You had to get 21 merit badges, really difficult. And it was beyond my grasp, you know. It wasn't easy to get.
Yeah.
And I knew I might not make it. So I accepted the challenge. And I didn't become an Eagle Scout.
Nice.
And it took a lot of work. The hardest merit badge was bird study, by the way. You had to identify 40 birds,
Yeah. Know
everything about them, be able to say everything about, and I had to go to scout camp to do that. little did I know, dummy, that Central Park has trillions of birds in the migration period. I thought New York had 3 birds only, the sparrow, the pigeon, and the seagull.
Wow.
I went scout, anyway.
Okay.
So when I got that, I realized I could go beyond my grasp and achieve. And it gave me the confidence that I can do that in other domains.
Yes.
And that's my advice to young people. Whatever success you've had, a good poem, a piece of art, a sport, a mechanical device, electronic, if you succeed in accomplishing a challenge you set for yourself or someone else gave you, keep that inside. Know you can do it. So when you meet the next challenge, don't say, "Oh my God, it's too hard." No, I can try and do it. So that's a lifelong lesson. But the other lessons are this. You don't need to have parents who have been in the field you're entering. In fact, sometimes it's a negative.
Yeah.
You don't want to have to beat them. Another thing, opportunities will come along. Don't set your path in a rigid direction and say, "This is what I'm going to do." You have to be able to pivot. And new things will come along. Don't ignore those opportunities. Investigate them. Maybe they're for you. Also, whatever work you do, whatever project you have, whatever piece of homework or production, do it well. Because you never know when it's going to be important. Don't be sloppy. Don't let somebody else do it for you. I remember as an undergraduate student, we'd have laboratory reports to write.
Yeah.
You get these measurements. They'd never be correct. You had to explain why.
Okay.
A lot of kids copied the last year's student. And I didn't do that. It was hard as heck.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to learn if I copy somebody's report.
Right.
So, you know, be honest about it. And again, don't set a rigid path for yourself. For example, don't say, "I'm going to become an excellent coder," because that was a mistake. We know now, right?
Whew.
Or don't just go into AI.
Yeah.
Keep it open. If something else comes along, use your skills. And by the way, when a field gets too crowded
and
too competitive, my advice is shift a little bit. Take your talents and move it into something that's close, but not identical to what you're doing. Yeah. Be ready to pivot.
Forge a unique path too. Wow, that's brilliant, by the way. And okay, lastly, and this is a little away from the what we've been talking about, but what is your secret to longevity? How have you been able to maintain this passion, articulate intelligence, energy, joy that just emanates out of you for so long? I mean, 60 plus years, being a forerunner, being on the Mount Rushmore of 20th century, 21st century now accomplishments, and still going and still excited and still just doing your thing. What are your secrets?
Well, the one secret I had nothing to do with, it's DNA.
Okay.
That was important.
Yeah.
But don't follow, another lesson is don't follow the pack.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a well-trodden path. You're not going to find diamonds or gold there.
Yeah.
And I never did follow the pack. And I'll never retire.
Shit.
Because working with students is about the best invigorator. They're bright. They're smart. They keep you young. They challenge you.
Yeah.
You enjoy. You get gratification out of teach. You know, getting a PhD is literally a course in research to teach somebody how to do research. So to teach someone to do that gives you the energy and the satisfaction it's going on. But look, I didn't follow the pack. As I say, I was not a joiner. I was a swimmer. Yeah. That's not a group.
Independent sport, absolutely.
I was a marathoner. One thing I do now, which is a group effort, I study karate, Japanese karate.
All right.
Shotokan
wow.
karate.
Wow.
And that is a group sport. But the reason I do that is, in my life as a professor, I don't have a boss.
Okay.
The chairman, the dean, the chancellor, you ignore them. You do what you want. I do the research I want.
Yeah.
I get the students I want. I teach the courses I want. But when I go to karate and sensei says bow, I bow. He says punch, I punch. So that yin-yang, a totally different world where you can let yourself go, is encouraging. And I've been doing it now for 42 years.
Holy cow.
And so that helps. But it's the, you know, Confucius is attributed to the following quote. I think other people said it as well. He said, choose a job that you enjoy and you'll never work a day in your life.
Yes. Yes.
And that's really important. They'll never pay you enough.
Right. Right.
They'll never pay you enough. It's your life, for God's sake.
True.
So, you know, and I enjoy my work and every aspect of it. And I mix it up a lot with the physical and the theoretical, both in the way I behave and the way I study. And, you know, to have a challenging problem is about the best there is. You know, when you go to sleep, you're thinking about it. And to break through, I remember once I had this great result, but I didn't know why the result was what it was. So I went to Shannon, as he's busy unscrewing the...
Yeah.
And I showed him the result. And in 5 minutes, he explained what it was, why I behaved that way. He taught me how to begin to think that way. It's, you know, to get, to accomplish something gives you so much joy.
Yeah.
It wants you to continue to do that. But again, I think, oh, by the way,
yeah.
In terms of longevity, not only in academia, but in terms of age.
Yeah.
A good wife that feeds you well.
Right.
Encourages right. you, is challenging, is not a, you know, just a...
Okay, kowtow to you all the time.
Yeah. You want constant challenge. You want concentration. And so sports, good food, good activity at work.
Yeah.
And DNA. The DNA I can't give you, but the rest right. you can get for yourself.
Wow. Well, look, I appreciate this. There's so much. This is our second real conversation. There might be a third in the offing to get to all the rest. But for the sake of time, I just want to say, look, on behalf of Los Angeles, to have one of the most important inventions, creations ever to come out of the city that I love so dearly, thank you. But on behalf of the world, what you've accomplished, I'm just honored truly to be in your presence. And thank you so much for taking the time to join us on the podcast. I really appreciate you. And just thank you, not just for being here, but for everything you've accomplished and done for the world. So
it's my pleasure. And I've had fun. So.
Well, it shows. And I thank you so much again, Professor Leonard Kleinrock, UCLA Distinguished Professor of Computer Science, and the man who is responsible for creating the internet and indirectly for creating this podcast. So thank you so much. And all right, LA, it's been a minute.
Understanding power requires more than headlines. I'm Peter Hamby, host of The Powers That Be, a podcast from PUC examining politics, economics, and media to provide context, analysis, and clarity without sensationalism. We ask how power operates, who benefits, and what's at stake. If you want to move beyond breaking news to deeper understanding, join us on The Powers That Be. New episodes every weekday. Follow The Powers That Be wherever you get your podcasts.